These patients should be given a face mask immediately.
What is a coronavirus in the coronavirus family?
When we're talking about diagnosis, we're looking at a detailed travel history.
That's an all-important question in terms of the transmission of this.
Currently, for diagnosis, we don't have a rapid test.
We're definitely in an interesting time.
This is just dangerous.
Welcome back to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. This is Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. So thankful that you're joining us for this podcast, this very important and very critical podcast. As all of you have been inundated with respect to the news and COVID-19 with the coronavirus, hearing about the latest breaking news, we're going to discuss some COVID-19 facts on this podcast. We're going to go through some recent articles that have been published in the Journal of American Medical Association, as well as some other related journals, related articles to COVID-19. Now, importantly, as we go through this particular discussion in this podcast, because the disease itself, evaluation, treatment of patients and folks across the nation and across the world continues to evolve on an almost daily basis, it's important for us to emphasize that certainly continuing to check updated CDC websites for guidance are the critical thing. But having said that, we are going to go through some important pearls, overall coronavirus family, the clinical course of this condition that we know of thus far, diagnosis, and right now, as we understand it, some important treatment pearls. So with that, John, let me bring you, Peter, Robin. How are you guys doing this particular podcast?
Doing well, Mike. Yeah, just trying to wrap ourselves around the COVID-19 updates, and I'm excited for this discussion.
Yeah, I think this is a great topic. It's very fast moving and really just a critical topic to discuss.
Yeah, I'm mostly happy that Mardi Gras has gone by without this in New Orleans. So we dodged one.
That you know of.
Yeah.
Agreed. Well, I think all of us are mired in endless probably meetings every day, maybe several meetings each day regarding preparation at our individual sites. So John, let me turn things over to you to kind of guide us through this particular discussion.
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. Thank you. So yeah, we're definitely in an interesting time. And I think, to be honest, a lot of the concern comes as we look back at previous pandemics and epidemics. I think the most notable one is the 1918 flu pandemic, where about, I think, 500 million people were infected with H1N1 virus, which was a third of the world's population. And back in 1918, obviously, the medical care that was able to be provided was a little bit different than today, but there was nearly 50 million deaths as a result of this viral outbreak. And so we've had a few along the way, which we'll discuss, of smaller outbreaks. But certainly in 2020 and this recent coronavirus outbreak, that's definitely a good time for us as clinicians to kind of review the standard treatments and what to look out for, and particularly if there's anything specific about this coronavirus that we should be doing in our emergency departments and ICUs. So I think we all are familiar with, in probably about December, when a novel coronavirus, which is now titled COVID-19, I think as we all are most familiar with hearing, was identified as responsible for a cluster of pneumonia cases that started out in what appears to be Wuhan, China. And as of today, March 2020, over 50 countries have identified patients who've tested positive for COVID-19, with a total of about 91,000 identified cases and 3,100 deaths to date. Now, the rapid worldwide spread of COVID-19 has led many leaders to suggest we may experience a global pandemic, which has left patients and all of us with a lot of questions. And as the discussion regarding this viral outbreak continues to grow, it's important for us not only to prepare locally, but to review standards for prevention, as a lot of that, and to be honest, a lot of us as healthcare workers are certainly in the front lines and at risk for contracting a viral infection. So we'll start with Rob. Why don't you walk us through what is a coronavirus in the coronavirus family? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, COVID-19 belongs to the beta coronavirus family, which is similar to SARS and MERS. But notably, COVID-19 has a significantly lower case fatality rate, about 3.1%. Put in context of influenza viruses, it also has a much larger scale. For example, seasonal influenza accounts for about 7.7 million annual cases and a case fatality rate of about 0.05%. But currently, we haven't reached those types of numbers in terms of COVID. In terms of transmission, COVID-19 is believed to have started as a zoonotic infection, in other words, an animal, and it's thought to be from either the pangolin or the bat, with a mutation that occurs to allow human-to-human transmission. And respiratory droplets are the primary vehicle for transmission, and it's thought mostly to occur in symptomatic patients, this transmission. Asymptomatic transmission has been reported, but hasn't really been confirmed. And a critical question remains is whether COVID-19 can be passed along during the incubation period or patients who have very mild disease. That's an all-important question in terms of the transmission of this. In terms of the clinical course, from reports out of China, the COVID-19 has the following characteristics. The average incubation period is thought to be about 5 days, more or less. And the early symptoms are fever, which is present in almost all cases between 85 to 98%. And notably, to distinguish it from like standard upper respiratory tract infections, notably, this affects primarily the lower respiratory tract. So you get cough in about 75 to 80% of cases and shortness of breath instead of like rhinorrhea and sore throat. And that's a very notable distinction that we can use in the ED with respect to other patients. There are also other symptoms that can happen like myalgias and headache, but those are less common. Approximately 10% of patients have GI symptoms in the first week, and so that's also less common than other types of viral illnesses. About 80%, in other words, most of cases are really mild, and we don't actually have an exact statistic as to how many patients are truly asymptomatic with this disease, but suffice it to say that most cases are mild. About 15% were defined as severe, with hypoxia, SO2 saturations less than 93%. About 5% of patients go on to develop critical illness requiring mechanical ventilation with respiratory failure, vasodilatory shock, or even renal failure. And in these patients, again, this is data from mainland China, ARDS and AKI and septic shock are uncommon, but appear to occur in around 5% of patients. And notably, 80% of COVID-19 deaths were in patients over the age of 60. And 75% of COVID deaths had comorbid medical diseases like hypertension, diabetes, or coronary artery disease. So again, the most critically ill patients and the patients who go on to die from this in general are going to be older with comorbid disease.
That's a great pearl, Rob. These are all based off of these very early reports coming out of some of the hospitals that have the largest subpopulation presenting with critical illness related to COVID-19 that appears like the sickest are the elderly, or at least greater than, maybe I shouldn't say elderly, but greater than 60 years old with some significant comorbidities. But again, as you wisely pointed out, there's still a lot we don't know in terms of transmission. So it's really important for us to obviously stay tuned to determine whether or not this is only with patients presenting with symptoms, but also keeping in mind that it's potentially possible that patients could transmit the disease without symptoms. So, Peter, why don't you talk to us a little about the diagnosis and how us as healthcare workers should approach patients who may be at risk or presenting with a concern for a COVID-19 infection?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's critical for us to understand that as of this podcast, which is March 2nd, 2020, this is the best data that we have. When we're talking about diagnosis, we're looking at a detailed travel history. We think that that's critical. Perhaps a month from now, that's going to be irrelevant, but we'll see. But the travel history is something that we think is currently pertinent, and current CDC recommendations suggest that anyone who's traveled to China, Iran, Italy, Japan, and South Korea, or has had close contact with a person with confirmed COVID-19 in the past 14 days should be considered a person under investigation. You know, people kind of call those PUIs, if you will. So a person under investigation. So patients suspected of possible COVID-19 infection, these patients should be given a face mask immediately, right? Even at triage, that's where they get it. They should be isolated as soon as possible in a negative pressure room, which means that many of the EDs across our country and other countries are going to be jam-packed with these individuals. And there may be just a shortage of these rooms. We think that healthcare workers should care for patients using appropriate personal protective equipment, or PPE, right? And so what's the PPE look like here? It should be contact droplet precautions. They're needed for non-aerosol producing procedures. So as long as we're not doing bronchoscopy or giving aggressive aerosol therapies that are kind of aerosolizing the virus. For aerosol generating procedures, an N95 mask or a respirator to include goggles or face shield, gloves, coverall, long sleeve gown, and negative pressure rooming for those patients receiving aerosol generated procedures. Strict hand washing, again, is the hallmark of all of this. And so you can't do that enough. I think it's important to understand that a large number of COVID-19 patients in Wuhan, China, are believed to have been healthcare-associated infections, and as high as 63%. So these aren't the patients that we really need to be up in their grill without a mask. This is just dangerous. I think one of the more virulent cases in China involved an ophthalmologist there. If your hospital or state has not set up any reporting mechanism, the CDC website is very helpful for more information, and this is regarding reporting. We'll offer some links in the handout to everyone. I think that'll be important, and it will be changing. Currently, for diagnosis, we don't have a rapid test, but we anticipate within the next 1 to 2 to 3 weeks max, those tests should be out there. From a laboratory standpoint, we want to look and investigate for end organ injury secondary to sepsis. So we're going to check CBC, BMP, COAGs, respiratory viral panel, blood cultures. Some people are looking at lactate, and some people are also looking at troponins. They noted that a high incidence of mild troponin elevation has been reported. It's unclear if this is secondary to stress cardiomyopathy or demand ischemia, or if it's linked to a viral myocarditis. But that tends to be the wrap-up for diagnostics.
Excellent points, Peter. And I think reemphasizing something that you pointed out was the importance of personal protection. With the rate of healthcare-associated infections being as high as 63%, you're right. This is no joke. We have to really look out for ourselves, because at the end of the day, if we can't take care of our patients, we're pretty much worthless. So definitely making sure that we're protecting ourselves with proper PPE, including an N95 mask, respirator, should we have to intubate any of those patients, really thinking about making sure we're wearing the proper face and body gear to do this without putting ourselves at risk is super important. And so kind of transitioning through that into treatment. So let's say there is a person who there's a high suspicion for COVID-19 infection, or even just the flu with the potential that they're going to be tested. We have to go on and treat this patient. Mike, if you could, walk us through at least what you're prioritizing in terms of treatment strategies and therapies that you're going to be instituting in the ED or early on in the ICU.
Yeah, and as we've said, for each of these categories, information and recommendations, guidance really continues to evolve on an almost daily basis. Before we get into treatment, let me just throw in a few other clinical pearls under diagnosis. So when you're evaluating these patients, as you heard from Rob, fever, cough, shortness of breath, you're going to get a chest x-ray on these patients and understand that it's about 60% sensitive for demonstrating the infiltrates characteristic of COVID-19. Now, CT scan, as we would expect, is much more sensitive, and the typical findings you're looking for, at least what's been reported thus far in these cases, is peripheral ground glass opacities that tend also to congregate and coalesce in the posterior lung segments. Now, in no way are we recommending that you scan everybody, because that risks further exposure to other hospital staff, other patients. But if you do have someone more on the side of a critical illness and you do obtain CT scans, that's what you're looking for. It tends to be peripheral posterior ground glass opacities in a bilateral distribution. The other clinical pearl that we've started to see in laboratory data, the majority of these patients don't have a leukocytosis, but what they do have in about 80% of cases is a lymphopenia. So that may be a clinical clue if you're getting a CBC on patients in addition to, say, a respiratory viral panel and you see a lymphopenia, that could be a tip or a nice pearl to say this is a possible or heightens your suspicion for COVID-19 patients. Now, in terms of treatment, because majority of this tends to be respiratory, they develop those bilateral ground glass opacities, start to develop respiratory failure. Really, the treatment thus far is kind of focused on respiratory support. Hypoxemia tends to be the patient's primary problem that we need to support them through. And so that raises the question, how best do we support and reverse someone's hypoxemia? And in general, therapies that we know of, so high flow nasal cannula, non-invasive ventilation, is where many of these patients are started in terms of respiratory support. That could be CPAP, BiPAP, or once again, the commercially available high flow nasal cannula devices. Now, at the time we're doing this recording, the World Health Organization, the interim guidance, does recommend that we move relatively quickly to intubation for any signs that patients are failing non-invasive respiratory support. Now, many patients in China have been treated with high-flow nasal cannula, but signs of failure would include patients who develop refractory hypoxemia. So you're titrating up the O2 with high flow nasal cannula or non-invasive, and you still have that overall low P to F ratio. So PaO2 to FiO2 ratio, specifically less than 100, is a sign that that patient's not improving, if not failing non-invasive support, and you move on to mechanical ventilation. Another pearl is when they start to draw large tidal volumes on BiPAP. So you're measuring this, your ventilator's showing you that they're pulling tidal volumes greater than 9 mL per kilogram of ideal body weight. That really suggests that the patient has a large amount of dead space and thereby is progressing to ARDS and should have mechanical ventilation instituted. And then, as we would also expect, anyone who is demonstrating increased work of breathing or just persistent tachypnea that's starting to tick up despite these non-invasive therapies really needs to move on to mechanical ventilation. Now, during the course of intubation, certainly this is a very high-risk aerosol-producing procedure, so we would refer you back to your specific infection prevention colleagues at your individual site for guidance at how your individual site to best handle that PPE during this high-risk procedure. Now, once you've gotten them intubated and initiated mechanical ventilation, if you continue to have refractory hypoxemia, this is very similar to the management of patients with ARDS from other causes that develop refractory hypoxemia. So you could consider proning in the ICU. You can consider lung recruitment maneuvers with ARDS. You can also consider neuromuscular blockade, and we realize that there's been some recent literature analyzing neuromuscular blockade for these patients, but it is worth considering these type of therapies in patients with refractory hypoxemia. In terms of some other supportive critical care treatment, fluids tends to be a little bit more on the conservative side. No need to overly aggressive resuscitate these patients with fluids if there's no evidence of hypovolemic shock. I think when they hit the door, they have fever, they have cough, they have respiratory symptoms, they may have infiltrates. Right now, you're certainly thinking, oh, COVID-19, but some of these patients will in fact turn out to have community-acquired or possibly healthcare-associated or hospital-acquired pneumonia. So early administration of empiric antibiotics until the dust settles, we get testing and can confirm that patient's COVID-19. Very reasonable to provide broad spectrum antibiotics, at the very least in the emergency department while you're working through the differential. Something else that's been sort of always considered in the treatment of many of these patients with ARDS is the utilization of steroids. They definitely have been widely used thus far in China to treat many of these patients, but there certainly is a significant concern that the utilization of corticosteroids may produce prolonged viral shedding. So it may also increase the chance of secondary infection, particularly atypical agents like fungal infections. Now, if we look back to the data where steroids were used in patients treated with SARS, they really didn't demonstrate any survival benefit and even potential harm with the utilization of steroids. So some similar recommendations are currently in print regarding COVID-19 with respect to steroids. They remain highly controversial and probably not something you would be jumping to right away in terms of treating these patients. So just to kind of go back, that's a lot to unpack there, but focusing on the respiratory support, reversing hypoxemia, give it a try initially with non-invasive therapies, but really monitor them closely for signs of failing non-invasive respiratory support and moving on to mechanical ventilation. Now, in terms of disposition, where do we send these patients? I think most of the recommendations you're seeing is in patients who come in and overall they look well. There are no signs of, say, tachypnea, hypoxemia. They may be a high-risk patient, but overall they've got an area to self-quarantine at home. They're reliable, able to follow home isolation, precautions, self-monitoring. Most of the recommendations are saying send those patients home with home quarantine. And at least in the United States, there's an easily referenceable document on the CDC website on what to do for patients when they're on home quarantine. Now, in terms of admitting patients, that's once again going to be something that you need to work out with your individual site infection prevention and infectious disease colleagues along with hospital administration. And really, if you don't have it thus far, you need to rapidly have a plan on where you're going to cohort these patients in a non-ICU setting. And then in terms of your ICU setting, are there specific areas in your hospital that these patients, when they perhaps need an ICU level care, when they're intubated, are you going to cohort them? And what's the staffing look like in those areas of the hospital? So, John, I know that was a little long-winded, but I think that covers most of what we know thus far for treatment.
No, I think that's great, Mike. And I think a lot of us, this is on the front of our brain in terms of what to do after the patient comes through the door in terms of supportive care. Because at the end of the day, this is a viral infection and there's not a lot we can do other than supportive care. I think that some of the pearls that I took away from you were certainly think quickly about progressing that patient to invasive mechanical ventilation rather than the non-invasive strategies. Certainly, we all know with previous medical literature that non-invasive failure is associated with a high mortality rate, and viral pneumonia is no different here. In fact, to be honest, high-flow nasal cannula, if anything, you know, it's a non-closed-loop system and certainly has the risk of aerosolizing that viral infection as well, so I might think twice about that. But the great pearl about the tidal volumes on BiPAP, greater than 9 mLs per kilo of ideal body weight, indicating progressive ARDS, I love that one. And then, obviously, the question about steroids, probably going to hold off on that in the emergency department. So, in general, gentlemen, excellent, excellent summary of what I should be looking out for as well as our audience. And just to summarize, I think some of the other key take-home points that COVID-19 is a novel coronavirus that's similar to SARS and MERS that we've all heard about in the news. And it's being rapidly identified across the country and the United States as well as the world. Certainly, we need to keep an eye out for that rapid test, which hopefully will be readily available by mid-March, as well as some potential antiviral treatments that are, I think, being rapidly tested right now, including remdesivir and a combo of lopinavir and ritonavir, which could potentially reduce the duration of symptoms and severity of COVID-19. Obviously, we need to take a detailed travel history when taking care of any patients coming in the ED with respiratory symptoms. But as we're getting more and more cases of asymptomatic or at least unknown contact that are testing positive, that detailed travel history in the next few weeks may not be as relevant as what we're trying to keep COVID-19 more contained in the past. Most COVID-19 patients who are positive presented with mild symptoms. So certainly from an education standpoint to our patients, it's important to reassure them that most people have mild symptoms and critical illness is rare. However, those patients that are older than 60 with multiple comorbidities, including cardiovascular or diabetic comorbidities, do seem to have an increased risk for significant complications. So certainly, once they come in, we're going to provide early supportive care and quickly get to mechanical ventilation if needed. And it seems like that's about 2 weeks after the initial infection where those progressive ARDS symptoms seem to take place. And then lastly, reminding to protect ourselves and reminding our colleagues to protect themselves when coming in contact with potential patients, as personal protective equipment is absolutely critical to make sure we're not adding to the statistics of iatrogenic spread. So what we'll do is we have a few articles listed at the top, which have definitely been helpful in going through this summary. The key article was by Dr. Yi and colleagues called The Novel Coronavirus in 2019. That was actually published in the first issue of the Open Access Journal of American College Emergency Physicians, as well as the JAMA article by Drs. Wu and a few others that describe the characteristics and important lessons that they've experienced from the COVID-19 outbreak in China. And lastly, at the bottom, we'll have some resources from the CDC, and certainly these will be readily available and hopefully being communicated to everyone listening from within their hospital. So with that being said, we'll wrap up here. I think we've gone through enough for today. Mike, Rob, Peter, thank you so much for the wonderful summary and wishing everyone out there a safe flu season as we wrap that up, as well as this upcoming concern for COVID-19. And certainly if there's any questions, please don't hesitate to email us and we'll get back to you as soon as possible.
Outstanding, John. Thanks for leading us through that discussion. Really nothing to add to the end with the exception of we understand all of us are overwhelmed with emails, communications, but certainly stay on top of this when you see COVID-19 emails in your inbox from your institution. Pay attention because they likely contain new information, new protocol updates about what your institution is doing from an isolation standpoint, treatment standpoint, disposition standpoint. So our thanks for listening to this podcast. Certainly, as John indicated, let us know if you have any follow-up questions on this topic. We're so thankful that you joined us here for this COVID-19 update. Once again, this is Mike Winters for the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and we will talk to you on our next podcast. Bye for now.